Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for June's Nurses Club webinar. I'm delighted to introduce you to our speaker for today, Senior Veterinary Nurse at Anderson Moores Veterinary Specialist, Denise Brisk. Thank you, Denise. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much, Ema. Hello and welcome. Yes, so we're going to talk in this webinar about anaesthesia and perioperative care and peri-anaesthetic care of the geriatric patient. Whilst older patients are more likely to have other diseases present, many of them are healthy, although physiological changes will always be present to some degree, and it's important to be aware of the changes that occur in old age. The CEPSAF report, that's the Confidential Inquiry into Perioperative Small Animal Fatalities, shows that the mortality rate of small animals, that's cats and dogs, over the age of 12 years increases by a factor of 7, so that's quite some hefty increase. Thorough preparation, monitoring and vigilance is needed in the peri-anaesthetic period to make sure that we can keep our patients safe. So what defines a geriatric animal? Well, there are many definitions out there. One of the ones which is perhaps the most common is when an animal has reached about 75, maybe 80% of its expected lifespan. That's quite subjective, and it depends what everyone expects the animal to live for. And this percentage definition assumes that there is a linear decline in physiological changes that's in line with age. And obviously, we know that's not always the case. You can have a very old dog that actually is quite healthy and has good liver and kidney function. And on the flip side, you can have a relatively young animal, which you might not necessarily define as being geriatric, but its health status is not good. So what we're trying to say really is that it's the physiological changes that affect anaesthesia, not the number. We do need to consider age-related changes, and those are primarily to do with the cardiovascular, central nervous system, renal, hepatic, and pulmonary systems, and also body condition, because older animals are more prone to obesity or maybe muscle wastage. Endocrine disorders are really quite prevalent in old animals, as is osteoarthritis, and that will have an effect on handling and positioning the patient whilst it's anaesthetised and before and after it's anaesthetic. And of course, they have sensory impairments. They may be deaf or blind or have some visual or hearing impairment. It's important to take a complete history when you're admitting any patient, but particularly older patients, and get any information that you can on drugs, because any drugs can interact with anaesthetic and analgesic drugs. And these might be prescription drugs that you know about, it might be prescription drugs that you don't know about, or it may be that the owner has put them on some form of complementary drug, a homeopathy drug, and many of these drugs will interact with the drugs that we give them, and that's especially true for the cognitive drugs and preparations. So we need to perform a complete physical examination and auscultation of the heart and the lungs. And laboratory data is very useful if the owner is willing for blood tests and urinalysis, because you may detect subclinical disease. Subclinical disease is a disease that's lurking, if you like, but hasn't manifested itself yet, so there are no symptoms. And this picture here, this is a very elderly Siamese cat that we knew was hyperthyroid and also had renal failure, which actually got worse after the thyroidectomy. This cat was presented for a sort of routine dental procedure, and on taking blood and urine samples, it uncovered that she also was diabetic. So, you know, any laboratory tests that you can perform that the owner is willing to, that they are really useful in the older animal. We're going to look at the system changes in turn, starting with the cardiovascular system. There are many changes here, including valve malfunction, and chronic valvular disease is very common in old dogs. Myocardial fibrosis is also common, that's thickened heart valves. Also, they get thickening of the ventricles. And if this happens, then there's decreased filling, decreased cardiac output, and decreased cardiac efficiency. And older animals will increase their cardiac output if they need to, not by increasing heart rate, which is what happens in young and adult animals, but by increasing their stroke volume. Stroke volume is the volume of blood which is pumped in one beat. And they depend much more on preload. And preload is the volume of blood that's in the left ventricle at the end of diastole. And if the ventricle wall is thickened, then the chamber size is smaller. And therefore, the preload isn't going to be as good. And these old animals can't really tolerate volume depletion. Looking at the central nervous system changes, well, there are loss of neurons and loss of brain cells, and also reduced brain size. As with all organ size, when it's reduced, we get reduced mass of liver and kidneys. Then the mass of the brain, unfortunately, also decreases with age. The blood flow to the brain is decreased, and there's decreased neurotransmitter activity. So here we're thinking about noradrenaline, dopamine, and serotonin. And this means that there are decreased requirements of the anaesthetic agents. And in particular, the MAC, the minimum alveolar concentration of the inhalant agent, is decreased in geriatric patients. What we're saying this means really is that potency is increased. So you need less of your isoflurane or sevoflurane for an older patient. You should really be able to knock the concentration of your vaporizer down. Renal changes, obviously we're all used to the older animal which has kidney issues. The size of the kidney decreases in old age, and that means that there's a decreased blood flow to the kidney and decreased glomerular filtration rate, which is very significant. The kidneys aren't able to retain sodium and water as well in old animals, and that results in the PUPD that we see in these sort of old kidney cats and dogs. It also means that hypovolemia and acid-base imbalance are not really tolerated very well. We need to be careful with intravenous fluid therapy because it may be difficult for the kidneys to excrete excess water. And I'm just going to touch on the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, because that is not as efficient in old age as it is when animals are younger. And the RAAS system is very important in regulating blood pressure. So we're just going to have a quick recap on how it should work normally. So if there's low blood pressure or low sodium in the extracellular fluid, the kidney produces renin. Renin is a proteolytic enzyme, and that means it breaks down protein. And that acts on angiotensinogen, which is a serum protein in the liver, and changes it to the peptide angiotensin 1, and then changes it on to angiotensin 2. And this will do one of two things. So over here on the left-hand side, it will either cause the adrenal cortex to produce aldosterone, and aldosterone leads to less excretion of sodium, chloride, and water, and therefore blood volume is conserved, and water and electrolyte balance is maintained, and ultimately blood pressure is improved. Or over here on the right-hand side, the angiotensin II will cause vasoconstriction, which again will put the blood pressure back up to normal. So this is how it should work in a healthy animal. But the response to blood pressure changes via the RAAS system in old animals is not as good. Hepatic changes, again, there's decreased tissue mass, meaning that there's decreased tissue clearance of drugs, and there aren't as many hepatic enzymes. Now, hepatic enzymes and hepatic blood flow are needed for the metabolism of drugs which go through the liver, and many of the anaesthetic drugs that we use are metabolised by the liver. And the decreased cardiac output of older animals results in decreased hepatic perfusion. There are other things as well. There are fewer clotting factors, so the patient with liver changes is more likely to bleed. There are fewer plasma proteins, and also glucose regulation is poor in geriatric animals. So if you've got a pre-op blood glucose, that's great, and it might be that you want to take a glucometer with you whilst your patient's under anaesthesia and check the blood glucose levels. For patients which have glucose regulation issues, then we should really be checking them under anaesthesia every 30 minutes. You might notice that there's a yellowing of the skin when clipping. Now, this dog here came in for ultrasound examination of the abdomen, and he had a very thin coat, and as you can see, he's white, and we could see that really he had a yellow tinge even before we clipped him, and the extent of the jaundice can be seen after clipping for ultrasound examination. So sometimes you can see this even when you just clip for a jugular blood sample or when you're going to put an IV catheter in. If you suspect jaundice, obviously it's worth examining the mucous membranes, so just have a look at the gum or pull the eyelid down, and you might get an indication of jaundice that way, which maybe hasn't been picked up before. To look at changes that happen in the pulmonary system, there are quite a few, and of course these are significant. So older animals will have decreased pulmonary and chest compliance. That means that the chest wall and the alveolar wall are not as elastic as they were, and that will have positioning considerations, especially if you use ties. If you tie the limbs out, then the chest can't expand very well, or if you put the patient in a trough or a cradle, you really need to make sure that its chest can expand and it can breathe properly, and that's especially significant for the barrel-chested breeds, many of the brachycephalic pugs and bulldogs that are barrel-chested. There's also decreased tidal and minute volumes, decreased efficiency of gas exchange, and decreased functional residual capacity. Functional residual capacity is the volume of gas that's in the lungs at the end of normal respiration. And this allows gaseous diffusion to continue between breaths. So it may be that you need to ventilate your patient to minimise the physiological changes that occur in the respiratory system in older age. In addition to that, lung elastin is reduced. Elastin is the elastic protein of connective tissue. So again, it means they become a little bit stiffer and can't expand as well. The oxygenation of arterial blood decreases with age, and the closing capacity increases with age. The closing capacity is the volume of gas that's left in the lung when small airways or small alveoli collapse or close in the dependent part of the lung. So if the patient's lying on its left-hand side, then the left lung is said to be dependent. It becomes squashed, doesn't it? So it can't expand as well. Now, the closing capacity also increases when the patient's on its back for a long time. So if you've got long dorsal recumbency, all of this will impair gas exchange and also further decrease the amount of oxygen in arterial blood. And also it accounts for ventilation perfusion mismatch. Old animals can't respond to respiratory depression and apnea as efficiently, so we really do need to monitor not only the fact that they're breathing, but are they oxygenating efficiently? So if you have a pulse oximeter, that's great. There is an increased risk of GI reflux under anaesthesia, and that's because of the reduced tone of the lower esophageal sphincter. It's not really anything to do with how much and when they were fed, but many of the drugs that we use will actually lower the tone of this sphincter. The old animal has also got reduced gastric motility, reduced secretions, and the pH tends to be lower, which means the acidity is higher. So we really don't want these animals to regurgitate under anaesthesia. We need to take the precautions that we'd always take to make sure that aspiration doesn't occur, but you really do need to make sure that you do things like keep the head raised until you've got the tube in place and until the tube has been cuffed. Don't lower the head, because if they have regurgitated, then they're at higher risk of aspiration. And make sure you've got some form of suction ready if you think this is actually a possibility. Body changes, body condition, the fact that there's often decreased skeletal mass, increased fat, loss of intracellular water and loss of plasma volume means that we are injecting anaesthetic drugs into a smaller volume so that there will be an increased plasma concentration of the drug. Increased adipose tissue means that lipid-soluble drugs take longer to be eliminated from the body. Decreased serum albumin means that there's decreased protein binding of drugs, and that can manifest as exaggerated effects. And a lot of the drugs that we use are protein-bound. And a decreased metabolic rate obviously means that there's going to be decreased metabolism of drugs, but it will also account for a reduction in body heat. I'm just going to touch on the cardiac index. The cardiac index measures the heart performance in relation to the animal's size. And as skeletal mass decreases, so too does the cardiac index. So what we're saying here is that the heart doesn't work as well in cachexic or debilitated animals. And whilst we don't measure cardiac index, it is important to realise that the heart doesn't work well in animals with muscle loss. And this is a fairly extreme photograph here of a dog, which we're going to come back to in just a moment. Now, thinking about muscle loss, we're all used to condition scoring animals according to the percentage of fat that they have. But now there's a relatively new concept, which is muscle condition scoring. The nutrition service at Tufts University in America has developed the WSAVA muscle condition score system, because animals which have lost muscle but not fat are difficult to score using the traditional body condition score system. So the body condition score assesses fat, and the muscle condition score assesses muscle. And this uses palpation of skeletal muscles over the skull, the scapulae, the spine, and the pelvis. Whilst we evaluate body fat with body condition score, it is possible for an animal to be overweight but still have muscle loss. And that's especially true in old animals, and those with some diseases. And a classic example here is the diabetic animal, which retains fat pads but loses muscle. And muscle mass is not always lost in the same proportion as fat. Geriatric patients will often lose muscle mass, and atrophied muscles will tire more easily, and that includes the respiratory muscles. I did email Tufts University twice, actually, to ask if I could show the muscle condition score chart in this presentation, and quite unusually, they didn't reply, so I haven't been able to show it. But if you you can either follow this link here, or if you just Google WSAVA Nutrition Toolkit and follow the links, that will take you to the body condition score of the dog and the cat, and I think there's a video, and it will also take you to the muscle condition score chart of the dog and the cat. So that's well worth having a little look at. So this is the dog that was in the picture a couple of slides ago. This is actually a boxer without a head, but it is a boxer dog. And he has a very low body and muscle condition score because he's lost fat and he's lost muscle. You can see, well, you can see the ribs. You don't need to palpate the ribs as you would if you were doing a body condition score system. You can actually see and count the ribs. But you can also see that there is no muscle. The spine is visible. The spinous processes of the spine are almost visible. And you can see here over his pelvis, these parts of his pelvis, the wings of the ilium are visible even without palpation. You can see that there's complete muscle loss here, and his scapulae were sticking out as well. So this dog has got a very low body condition score and a very low muscle condition score. It wasn't actually a cruelty case. I know it looks like it, but it had a debilitating disease. And although this isn't the best breed to demonstrate it with, this cat has got a low muscle condition score, but actually there wasn't really any loss of fat. I know it's a Siamese or some oriental breed, but if we palpated here between the skull and down the spine, the muscle condition score was quite low, but fat pads were evident, and the ribs, you know, they were as we would expect for this sort of breed. Other things that we need to take into consideration are that older animals are often likely to have osteoarthritis, or if that's not actually been diagnosed, they'll be stiff in the joints. So gentle handling of limbs and padding prominences. We need to make sure that all the prominences are extra well padded to avoid decubital ulcers. And so here we've got the two different dogs. The one on the left, you can see that there's a foam pad underneath the elbow, even though the elbow is on a vet bed. And then the old lady on the right, she was going into the CT scanner, and so her legs needed to be pulled forward. And I don't know if you can see there, but there's a foam pad underneath both of the elbows. Remember, animals who are unconscious can't feel pain as such, but they do have nociceptive input, and nociception during anaesthesia will manifest itself as pain in the conscious animal. So if you're not careful during the anaesthetic period, they will wake up and be painful in their joints. If you can position them in a way that means that they can their limbs are relaxed and their chest can expand, that's great. So if you can avoid the troughs for keeping them in dorsal recumbency and avoid ties, that's brilliant. So here we've got an animal which is on its back. It's actually going to have elbow arthroscopy, so its legs are slightly positioned outwards, but it's being kept on its back with sandbags. There's plenty of room for its chest to expand, and I don't think you can see it that well, but it's also on this here is a it's an inflatable support. I think it's a Buster Cruise vacuum support. So it's like a beanbag, and it means that we don't have to use a trough to keep them on their back. They're often going to have sensory or visual impairments, and you can see this old dear departed now, Ringo, he's only got one eye to start with, and he's got a big cataract in his other eye. So we need to make sure that you approach them carefully and reduce stress, even if they aren't visually or impaired or if they're not deaf. Reducing stress means that we reduce the risk of catecholamine release. Catecholamines are neurotransmitters and hormones which are concerned with the sympathetic as well as the central nervous systems, so things like adrenaline and noradrenaline, which are responsible for the fight, flight and fright stress response. Release of catecholamines will result in increased heart rate, increased respiratory rate, the blood pressure shoots up, and the oxygen demand increases as well. And the patient may or may not be able to respond to that increased oxygen demand. And it can cause cardiac arrhythmias. And stimulation of the sympathetic nervous system will also cause vasoconstriction of the vessels to the viscera, so to the organs, and that means that there'll be less perfusion of vital organs, so there'll be less blood flow to the kidneys, the liver, the heart, and the brain. And geriatric patients have got reduced responses to catecholamines, so we do really need to keep the stress down. And if necessary, use signs to alert other people that the animal is blind or deaf. So here we've got a very old, this is a 15-year-old Clumber Spaniel that was completely deaf. And we've just got a sign on the door so that people know if it's not facing you, don't just go in and tap it on its bottom, because it will be very startled. And as well as sensory impairments, many old animals will have some degree of cognitive dysfunction. And if they do, they're going to become very confused and anxious in the practice, and that means that they will be stressed and there will be sympathetic nervous system stimulation. Okay, so for the next little section, we're going to look at drugs, and drug choices are obviously those of the veterinary surgeon, but it is important to understand why some drugs are used and other drugs are avoided, and how they affect the older patient. We need to think about the metabolic pathways for drug elimination. So if the patient has liver failure and there is a drug available that is metabolized by extrahepatic pathways, then that might be one to consider. The distribution of lipid and water-soluble drugs is altered because of decreased muscle mass, decreased total body water content, and an increase in fat. And drug dosages are reduced in old patients because of the reduced drug distribution, reduced metabolism and excretion, together with an increased sensitivity to drugs. So we're going to look at drug groups now and decide whether they are good or not good to use in geriatric patients, starting off with the opioids. And so we've got the partial opioid agonist, that's not strictly true actually. Over here we've got buprenorphine, and that is a partial agonist. And over here we have butorphanol, which is technically it's an agonist-antagonist. So buprenorphine, very good for mild pain, mild to moderate pain. Butorphanol is no good for pain. It is a useful sedative, but we wouldn't use that for analgesia. But all of the opioids can be antagonized. So yes, these are good drug choices to use for older animals. The pure opioid agonists, We've got here morphine, and over here Comfortan, which is methadone. Obviously, there are others. I think these two are probably the two most common in use. You would also have fentanyl in this group and pethidine. So the pure opioid agonists provide excellent analgesia. They will also provide some degree of sedation in the old or sick patient. And they can all be antagonized. So yeah, these are good drug choices. And the antagonist for any of the opioid drugs is naloxone. If you use naloxone because you don't like the effects that the opioid has had, maybe its respiratory rate has dropped a little bit too much, or maybe it's just a bit too sedate, then yes, you can antagonize with naloxone. But remember, this will also reverse the effects of any analgesia. So you'll then need to go back and think about providing analgesia. The other thing is naloxone does only last for about 30 minutes. And obviously, most of the opioids last for a lot longer. So if you've given methadone or morphine, it will last for about 4 hours. So you may need to give several lots of naloxone, because when it's worn off, the effects that you didn't like in the first place will come back. The next group we're going to look at is the benzodiazepine drugs. The two that we use in the UK are diazepam and midazolam. These drugs are very good for anxious patients because they do have anxiolysis as one of their properties, so they will take away the anxiety. And also for old animals only, they may cause some degree of sedation. Not for your young animals. If you give benzodiazepine to a young or an adult animal, it won't sedate it. But for old animals, it may well sedate it. And there is minimal cardiovascular and respiratory effects. They can also be antagonized. So benzodiazepines generally are appropriate to use. The antagonist, if you have it, is flumazenil. So this is an injection which is given intravenously, and this will antagonize the effects of any of the benzodiazepines. The next group is the alpha-2 agonists. So here we've got medetomidine, Domitor, and then we've got dexmedetomidine, Dexdomitor, which is in two strengths. No, this is not a good group to use. Generally, we would avoid the alpha-2 agonist agents. They have profound cardiovascular effects, and geriatric animals aren't really very able to compensate for a slow heart rate. If you remember at the beginning, I said that they increase cardiac output by increasing stroke volume because they can't really increase their heart rate. The alpha-2s will also produce, or can also produce, cardiac arrhythmias, and in particular, second-degree heart block. And you can get blood pressure swings. They cause this biphasic blood pressure thing, where initially blood pressure goes up, and then it will drop. And young animals, adult animals, can compensate. They can cope with these blood pressure changes, but old animals don't cope very well with changes in blood pressure. So as a rule, we would probably not use the alpha-2 agonists, or if they are used, then we'd use very, very low doses. Obviously, they can be antagonized with atipamezole. The induction agents that we use, over here we've got propofol. This is Vetofol, which is the propofol with no preservative. Generally, we'd probably just use this for young patients under 6 months of age. Propofol, which I guess is the type that most of you are used to, which is the general propofol with preservative. Alfaxolone, and then for completeness, I've just put in a picture here of etomidate, although I'm aware of the fact that that's not really in general use. All of these agents are fine for induction. Alfaxolone and Etomidate particularly are very cardiovascular stable. These are really good choices and for patients with heart issues, and these are very popular with the medics. For anyone who does use or may be considering using Etomidate, you must give a benzodiazepine, so diazepam or midazolam, before giving Etomidate, because there's very poor muscle relaxation and excitement is likely on induction, and depending on how long the procedure is, maybe recovery as well. All of the induction agents, whichever one you decide to use, must be given slowly. You must allow for slow circulation time and the fact that there is decreased neurotransmitter activity. So these agents take longer to get to the brain. It is easy to overdose, so do allow for the slow time it takes before you can actually see the effect. Other things that you might use, drug combinations. So we've got here, we've got fentanyl injection, phentodone is the trade name at the moment, and ketamine. Now, either of these you could combine with a benzodiazepine for induction. So you could give fentanyl, midazolam or diazepam, or ketamine, midazolam, diazepam combination. You just need to consider the hepatic and renal implications for ketamine. So with cats, there's very little hepatic metabolism of ketamine. It's mostly excreted unchanged by the kidneys. But with dogs, there's extensive hepatic metabolism. The non-steroidals, we've got Metacam and Carprofen. Non-steroidals are okay if there are no renal, gastrointestinal or blood pressure issues. It may be that you give your non-steroidal after induction of anaesthesia, or maybe when the fluids have been started, or maybe you give it post-operatively or after the anaesthetic when the blood pressure is normal. And alternatives to non-steroidals, we've got here, this is intravenous form of paracetamol for dogs. Obviously you can get paracetamol orally, you can get the tablet. The trouble with the tablet is it is only one strength. It only comes as 500 milligrams. And so you'd have to be very careful and make sure you can get an accurate dose. So we're really only looking at the larger dogs that could have the tablets. But you can get paracetamol suspension. You can get that across the counter. It comes in two strengths. It's for children and for babies. So you can get it in as 50 mgs per mil, or the lower strength, which I think is 24 mgs per mil, and that does allow much more accurate dosing. Now, this is obviously on the cascade system, and you can walk into any pharmacy and get paracetamol. I used the oral paracetamol for my old dog in his last few months because I didn't want him to have Metacam because of his kidneys. I did have to tell the pharmacist it was for my child, which is odd because I don't have one, and if I did, it wouldn't be a baby. But anyway, I bought the paracetamol and it did him very well for his last couple of months. Paracetamol is not a non-steroidal. It doesn't fall into that group because there are no anti-inflammatory properties. The other thing, of course, that we use a lot of for post-operative pain management is tramadol, and tramadol again is on the cascade system, but it does come in various strengths. So it might be that either of these drugs are considered if non-steroidals are not appropriate. And the other group which must definitely not be overlooked is the local anaesthetic agents. Now, these are excellent because you can combine a local anaesthetic with an opioid for an epidural, or you could give the local anaesthetic on its own as a nerve block, or maybe just splash it over the wound, or an incisional on stitching up. So they're really very good. They block the transmission of pain, and they also block the stress response to surgery. and they allow lower doses of other anaesthetic drugs to be used. So if your animal has had an epidural or it's had a dental block and it's worked well, you can definitely use a much lower concentration of your inhalant agent. All the local anaesthetic agents undergo hepatic metabolism, so that must be taken into consideration. So the ones that I think we use commonly, Marcaine here is bupivacaine. In the middle, maybe less commonly used, probably because it's a bit more expensive, this is Narapin, which is ropivacaine. It's very similar to bupivacaine, but it has fewer cardiovascular effects. So it's maybe a little bit more, dare I say, safer to use. And then obviously over here, we've got lidocaine. And on the next slide, you can see here we've got a simple nerve block. This here is, I think we're just using lidocaine here, and it's an infraorbital block prior to dental procedures. Simple to carry out, very effective, means that you need less concentration of your inhalant agent and less analgesic maybe in the post-op period if you were to use some bupivacaine or ropivacaine, which lasts longer. And then here we've got lidocaine going in as a CRI. Lidocaine is brilliant for painful surgeries, particularly abdominal surgeries. So it's very, very good for GDVs, spleens, excellent for anything with ulcerative guts, so ulcerative colitis. Apart from its analgesic effects, it does have other beneficial properties. It mops up free radicals. Lots of good properties. You don't necessarily need a syringe driver to give lidocaine. If you have got one, then that's brilliant. You can just fill your syringe with lidocaine. This is for dogs only. You need the lidocaine without adrenaline. But if you don't have a syringe driver, or if you've run out of them, you can dilute your lidocaine right down to 1 mg per mil and put it in a bag of saline and then just use it with an infusion pump. So you don't necessarily need fancy equipment to give a lidocaine CRI. Okay, so we move on to some general nursing practicalities. We've said about reducing stress because of the release of catecholamines, so reduce stress from admittance. And for older animals, familiar objects from home are going to be very useful. It may be a blanket, it may be a toy. I had an old dog come in last week and the owner left his jumper. Old animals are more distressed at leaving their owner than any other animal. Puppies, yeah, maybe a little bit. Oh dear, you know, mum's gone. But everybody fusses over puppies and the puppy soon forgets the mother and is fine with being fussed over. And I think old animals tend to be less fussed over. And even if they are, they actually really would prefer their owner to be there. They do become very anxious. They need to be kept warm perioperatively. And if you are going to use an agent that causes vasodilation, such as acepromazine in old animals, they definitely need to be kept warm. Acepromazine isn't really a great agent to use for pre-medication of old animals because it's very long-lasting. It does make their blood pressure drop and it makes them cold, and you can't reverse its effect. So if it's going to be used, it would have to be very low dosage. And gentle handling and positioning. They may have osteoarthritis or stiff and painful joints, and they may be painful on recovery. Be careful, because they're not going to like placement of needles or catheters. So if you can use local anaesthetic, Emla cream if you have time, or the cold spray. For the Emla, you really do need to apply it 45 minutes before you're going to attempt catheterization. So you need to clip, put your Emla on, keep it on with... It needs an occlusive dressing, so really the best thing is cling film. That's the best and cheapest option. Just wrap a bit of cling film and then wrap that up with vet wrap. If you haven't got cling film in the practice, then just cut up a latex glove. This will just blunt the pain response and reduce stress. And I don't know if people are familiar with this cold spray, which has been around in the NHS for a long time. It's called EthiCalm. It's ethyl chloride. It's a cryoanalgesic, which means it produces analgesia from very, very cold temperatures. And there's very rapid evaporation on the skin, and that causes a local freezing temperature. And that will make the skin numb until the skin temperature heats up, which is about 2 minutes. It says in the data sheet 2 to 5 minutes. Now, it's used in hospitals for children or for people who don't like needles, and they will spray it directly on the skin. We don't spray it directly onto animals because they really wouldn't like that. So just spray it for about 5 seconds onto a swab. Be careful how you pick the swab up because it is very cold. And then just wipe it over the site of wherever the needle or the catheter is going about 5 times. And then really, I'm a big convert. It works very, very well. They really don't mind it. So it's a useful alternative if you don't have time for EMLA. Think about where you're going to induce anaesthesia, and is it a stress-free area? If you don't have a quiet room, if you're inducing anaesthesia in a busy prep room where there are barking dogs, maybe dogs walking through or cats being carried through in a basket, we just put around a few signs. It says quiet please, but people know that really they can't walk through the room if these signs are out. And then just until you've induced anaesthesia, your patient's intubated and it's connected up to the breathing system, and then normal activity can resume. Pre-oxygenation before and during anaesthesia is a good thing to do. It maximises the oxygenation of tissues and it helps prevent hypoxemia and desaturation at induction. It must be stress-free. Otherwise, you'll get the stress response and catecholamine release, and it will be counterproductive. So on the left here, we've got a cat which is in the incubator. Obviously, this is completely non-intrusive method. He does look a little bit stressed, but I think that's because I'm pointing a camera at him. The downside of the incubator is that as soon as we open the door, the benefits are lost. On the right, we've got, this is a pug. It's been induced and we are just about to intubate it, and so somebody is holding the end of the circuit very close to the pug's mouth in this case, because it's a pug, it's got very, very narrow nostrils, so hold the end of the circuit over the nose or the mouth. The aim is to increase the fractional inspiration of oxygen from 21% thereabouts, which is what it is in room air, to something a bit higher. If you could use a tight-fitting mask, then you'd probably increase it to 60%, which would be great. But in a conscious patient, that's going to be quite stressful. If you hold the end somewhere near the nose and mouth, you may increase it only by 25%, maybe up to 40%. And then when your patient is anaesthetized, we need to think about positioning. And I've put this slide in here really because of a what's wrong with this position. So this is the same cat actually that was in the incubator that was being pre-oxygenated, and he is going to have a thyroidectomy. And he's positioned with his neck over a rolled up towel or sandbag at the request of the veterinary surgeon. But his head is actually lower than his neck, so that means that respiration is going to be impaired. And if the head is in a lower position than the rest of the body, it also will reduce the functional residual capacity. So this needs to be moved along so that his head and neck are level with his spine. So that's one thing that's wrong. I don't know how well you can see this, but his arms, his forelegs, are tied cordally. So there's a tie, there's one tie here over both legs, and they're pulled backwards. And tying the limbs will definitely reduce the compliance of the chest. It means the chest can't expand as well. Maybe just loosely filled sandbags over each leg would keep them in the position. Do they need to be tied out at all? They might actually stay where they are by the time the drapes are on. And because the legs are tied and he's in a trough, there's little room here in the trough for his chest to expand. So there's quite a lot wrong with the positioning of this patient. So we need to think about taking into account the requirements because of the procedure and what the veterinary surgeon wants. And from an anaesthetic point of view, how can we make this patient as safe as possible? Make sure the corneas are lubricated. So after induction, just check your palpebral reflex if you need to, and the position of the eye. Lube the eyes. I always then tape the eyes shut, and that just protects them from all sorts of things, flying hair, air if you've got a bear hugger, water if it's being sprayed from a dental. If you don't tape the eyes shut, then repeat the lubrication as necessary. And that's especially important for brachycephalic breeds. And it may be a dog or a cat. Persian cats are very brachycephalic now. British shorthaired cats are falling into that category. And also rabbits. There's quite a concern now for brachycephaly in rabbits, in particular Netherland dwarf, lion heads, and the Lop breeds of rabbits. So just make sure all these eyes are well protected. Choose a circuit with a low flow rate if possible, because that will maintain temperature. So use a rebreathing system if you can. Multimodal analgesia means that you can keep the inhalant agent low. There'll also be less vasodilation, because all the inhalants cause vasodilation, and that means that there'll be less heat loss and less blood pressure drop. Monitoring as much as you can, really. Just use whatever equipment you have available. So if you have a Doppler that's at the back of the cupboard, now is the time to get it out. Periop intravenous fluid therapy, yes, it is needed. We just need to be careful that we don't overload them with sodium and water. And an early return to normal is needed for these patients because they do get dysphoric. For the next section, we're going to just look at each of these complications in turn. So those which may occur, hypothermia, yeah, is quite likely, bradycardia, hypotension. And I've put hypoventilation, that's probably the most common, but you may get any ventilation issues. In the same way, bradycardia, it may be cardiac arrhythmias, but we're not going to cover arrhythmias in this webinar. Starting with hypothermia, why are old patients in particular susceptible to hypothermia? Well, they're prone to hypothermia because they have a lack of brown fat. Brown fat is the type of fat which generates heat, so it's thermogenic adipose tissue. There's a lot of brown fats in neonates and young animals and people. Adults do have some brown fat, but it tends to be less as we get older. Brown fat has a lot of mitochondria which burn energy and therefore produce heat, and it's a type of non-shivering thermogenesis. So, in other words, heat production, but not because we have to shiver. White fat is the type of fat that most of us don't like because it's the type that stores calories. And old animals are less able to respond to fluctuations in temperature, and they have a decreased basal metabolic rate and a decreased muscle mass. Now, there are lots of bad sides to hypothermia, lots of deleterious effects, and I've only really listed some of them here. Hypothermia is the biggest cause of bradycardia and delayed recovery. So there's an increased likelihood of bradyarrhythmias, an increased chance of surgical site infection, because in hypothermia there is vasoconstriction in a bid to warm the core. And because of vasoconstriction, that means there's reduced blood flow to the surgical wound. There's also coagulopathies, blood starts to clot less well in cold states, and a negative effect on antibody defenses because there will be suppressed phagocyte activity. And again, that will lead to an increased chance of surgical site infection. There's also profound respiratory and central nervous system depression in hypothermia. So ideally, we would prevent rather than treat hypothermia, and it may be that your patient's got cold in spite of preventative measures, and then we have to go ahead and treat it. Well, the first thing to do is decrease the concentration of your isoflurane or sevoflurane, because that will lessen the vasodilatory effects. Reduce your fresh gas flow if you can, especially for non-rebreathing systems. And if you have capnography, use your capnography to set your fresh gas flow. So if you find you're on 2 litres per minute and it's not rebreathing CO2, then knock it down to 1.5. If it's still not rebreathing any CO2, just keep knocking it down until your inspiratory CO2 creeps up to 1 or 2 millimetres of mercury. Remember that as they get deeper and colder, they breathe less often. So the cat that started out at 25 breaths a minute and is maybe on 3 litres per minute on a T-piece, if it's been in surgery for 1 or 2 hours, it's got deeper and it's got colder, its respiratory rate has probably halved, and that means you can probably halve your fresh gas flow rate. Add in a humidity and moisture exchanger to the end of the circuit if you're not already using one, and that again is especially for non-rebreathing systems. It will warm and humidify the air as it's being breathed in. You might need to supply active warmth, especially if they are sort of 35 degrees or lower. Not on the surface though, or on the extremities, because that will just cause vasodilation and make your heat loss worse. If you have an open body cavity that needs to be lavaged, make sure the fluid is warm. That will actually warm them up quite well. And Wheatie bags are very good wrapped around the inspiratory limb of your circuit. Again, especially your non-rebreathing system. So if you wrap your warm wheat bag close to where the patient's breathing in on the inspiratory limb, that will help. Or you can wrap it around the giving set of your fluids. Again, it needs to be quite close to where the fluid is entering, so quite close to the catheter. Bradycardia is usually because they are too deep or too cold, or maybe it's because of drug effects. And if they have a low heart rate, then they're going to have reduced cardiac output, reduced tissue perfusion, hypoxia and hypotension. So check the depth of your anaesthesia and lighten the plane if you can. Check the body temperature and warm it, and assess your fresh gas flow and reduce that if you can. Have a look at your blood pressure, increase or start the fluids. If you think it's because of drugs, then you can antagonise them, reverse them if possible. And you might need to use anticholinergic drugs. We're talking atropine here, or maybe glycopyrrolate. Atropine is probably the most common one. Just need to be careful, because they will increase the oxygen demand and the cardiac work is therefore increased. Hypertension during general anaesthesia reduces renal perfusion and glomerular filtration rate by up to 45%, and that's in any anaesthetised patient, not just the geriatric ones. So hypertension, we're looking here at a mean arterial pressure of 60 millimetres of mercury or lower, and a systolic pressure of 80 millimetres of mercury or lower. And there is inadequate tissue perfusion at these pressures, and that's very significant for vital organs. So the first thing to do, knock down your inhalant agent concentration, and that, together with warming up, will often sort out your blood pressure issues. If decreasing the concentration of your inhalant agent means you need to add in an analgesic agent, then ask your veterinary surgeon if that's what you can do. You may need to give fluid boluses of crystalloid fluids. If that doesn't work, maybe you need to use a colloid fluid. And if that doesn't work and you have the wherewithal to do it, then the drugs that we use, dopamine, as is the picture here, and dopamine and dobutamine, they need to be given via constant rate infusion, or a drug such as ephedrine can be given just as a bolus drug. Hyperventilation, similarly, often because they're too deep or too cold. So check the temperature and warm them up, and check the plane of anaesthesia and lighten them if necessary. If it's not remedied, hypoventilation will lead to hypercapnia and acidosis, so we do need to take action. It might be that you need to assist ventilation, IPPV, or put them on a ventilator. Just be a bit careful with IPPV and ventilator settings because they may have stiff lungs, so we need to use lower pressures so that we don't damage the alveoli. And post-operatively, we need to continue fluid therapy really until they're eating and drinking. Empty the bladder of all patients, but especially elderly patients wake up dysphoric and disorientated, so they need to be comfortable. And complications during post-op period include a prolonged and maybe not smooth recovery because of dysphoria, hypothermia and hypotension. We need to make sure that there is no breakthrough pain, so they need ongoing analgesia, and they need that for welfare and well-being, but also to reduce the chances of complications such as impaired ventilation, a lack of appetite, which might lead to ileus, gut stasis. They're likely to self-mutilate if they're in pain, and we don't want acute pain turning into chronic pain. And depending on the species, signs of pain may or may not be apparent. And some species, and that's cats and some dog breeds, as well as small mammals, will hide or not exhibit signs of pain. So we're all familiar with the stoic terrier and the wimpy greyhound and whippet. But the signs that you might see are behavioural signs, maybe excessive sleeping, a general lack of interest, an animal that wasn't aggressive before, now turning aggressive, or the other side, an animal that was nice before suddenly becoming aggressive, and vocalisation. Postural signs, you can see here, this little terrier is hunched over, his head's on his vet bed, his back legs are stretched out, he's looking miserable, he's got tummy ache. They might guard any painful areas. They're less likely to eat if they're in pain, and physical parameters that shoot up are temperature, pulse, respiration, and blood pressure. And pain scoring is very useful. There are many systems available now to pain score patients, and that's from the simple visual analog or numerical rating to the more complex composite scales. So in summary, the post-op requirements are warmth, oxygen. Maybe they need supplementary oxygen. They've gone from 100% oxygen during anaesthesia to 21% in room air. Comfort, nice beds, nice blankets, comfortable blankets, analgesia. Food and water, there's very few contraindications now to feeding within a couple of hours of regaining consciousness. And on top of that, they need TLC. There's more emergence delirium in old animals than in any other patient because of decreased neurotransmitter activity. So just to finish off with is a little story about this dog here. This is Diesel. So we'll start here. This is Diesel. He came in with a septic abdomen. This is post-op. So he's had his surgery. He's very uncomfortable. He was pacing. He was restless. He couldn't sleep. He hadn't slept. Then he settled in the corner, but you can see how miserable he looks. He's just leaning into the corner and he looks very sorry for himself. So he was pain scored and given analgesia. And then after his analgesia, a nurse got into the kennel and sat with him. And here he is. He went to sleep very happily on his back, which was probably more comfortable for him. And this is the nurse here. And after some time, we required her to come back to work. So here you can see he slept through this whole change of personnel. This is one of the ward assistants. She went in, she took over from Lucy. Diesel didn't wake up at all. And she sat with him for some hours. And he was very painful. So TLC definitely needed for our older friends. Thank you very much. If anyone has any questions, then obviously I'll be very happy to answer them.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Denise for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.